You are listening to The Edge, AM 1550, WURP, Braddock, Pittsburgh.
Good morning, Pittsburgh diners and travelers, and good afternoon to our overseas listeners, and good morning to Peter Rabbit.
Yeah, and don't forget, good day to our friends down under.
Right, true.
And our friends in Europe are having a very confusing time because we're on daylight saving time and they're not.
Right, in fact.
So we hope they figured it out because it's only 4 hours difference between here and London, and we're hoping our London caller later in the show will get that figured out too.
Oh, that's right. And we're having somebody call from London.
But I think we talked about that, and I think we're okay. And we have a guest on the line already.
We do. Marcia, welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Marcia Johnson has, it turns out that we're, you know, there's 2 degrees of separation or 1 degree of separation. She lives right next door to where we lived in Kansas City. Marcia, your product is called Brownie Pops. Could you give us a little background, though? I mean, how did you end up back in Kansas City, and what was your culinary background?
My bio says I'm from a long line of bakers who never met a cookie they didn't like.
Uh-huh.
And we're not life is short, eat dessert first. We're kind of life is short, eat dessert only kind of a family.
That's like Peter's family. Well, you traipsed around a little bit before deciding to set up shop back at home, right?
Yes, I did my traipsing in Los Angeles, uh-huh, where I taught cooking classes, and then I moved on to Chicago, where I had a wholesale American dessert bakery, and I supplied about 40 restaurants American desserts. I did mousse pies, that's not so American, chocolate cakes, carrot cakes, brownies, chocolate chip cookies, blondies. And then I got married in Chicago, and we moved to my hometown of Kansas City.
Right. What gave you the idea for Brownie Pops?
Well, I went into full-service catering when I moved here. We're the, oh, I'm going to offend someone I know, the home of the chain. We've gotten a lot better in the last 23 years, restaurant-wise, but when I first moved back, there were no takers for luxury desserts, so to speak.
Right.
And I did full-service catering as I've trained at Cordon Bleu and La Varenne and Peter Kumps, and I've taken from almost anybody who was anybody or wanted to be anybody or might be anybody. So for 20 years I did catering, but I seem to still be known for my desserts. And one dessert I cannot master, I'm not shy to say, is the pétifor. I cannot get my fondant icing to run properly, so I would take my brownies and dip them in chocolate, and that would be my pétifor.
So that's how they came into existence. Well, we remember Kansas City when the Hereford House was the place you went to eat steak, and if you wanted a decent meal, you went to the American restaurant in that big hotel in Midtown in Hallmark Center. There wasn't, and there was a great Chinese restaurant and a shopping center.
Is it still there? Yes, it's still there. It's Cantonese.
Yeah, it's still there.
Or is it Mandarin? No, it's Mandarin, right?
I don't
Mandarin.
Know. I remember we ate a lot of catfish, too.
I didn't.
No,
no, I mean, I always lost in those buffets, those all-you-can-eat catfish specials, and I lost that one.
So that's how brownie pops were invented by mistake?
Yes, thank you. By necessity.
By necessity. Now, what gave you the idea of putting a stick on them?
I knew you were going to ask. I was trying to come up with a good reason. anywhere from I didn't want my children's hands to get dirty. That sounds plausible. The real reason, it's just easier to dip them in chocolate if they're on a stick.
I see. Okay.
So they're not consumer-friendly, they're producer-friendly, but it turns out they're also consumer-friendly as well.
Yes, they are. You know, the Minnesota State Fair every summer only serves food on sticks.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
But now Brownie Pops then became something of an industry, or
I decided to stop dragging around large cases of tenderloins and I traded that in for 50-pound boxes of chocolate. So I don't know where the trade-off was, but I'm back doing the desserts that I love.
So you do more than Brownie Pops.
I do a little bit. I have some, I do the Dean and DeLuca stores. I do 3 of them across the country. With Brownie Pops. And then the one here locally in Kansas City does carry my hand-iced sugar cookies. And I also will be doing some flourless desserts for them for Passover.
Uh-huh.
And I'm kind of a, if you want it, I'm happy to make it person.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But now, how can listeners away from where there's a Dina and Luca store, how do they lay their hands on brownie pops? I mean, these are really extraordinary.
We are not
great dessert eaters, but we did consume the brownie pops.
Well, you know, I got caught. I'm good. You let out some information that you probably would not have wanted to have let out, and I'm going to come clean also. My husband thought that there had been a mouse in the box with the brownie pops, because I went and I nibbled on each one.
In fact, I did speculate first if they were defective.
Oh, great.
Now
the mouse would have to open the packaging because they come individually wrapped in the six pack. I don't know if yours were. If they were, then you had a very efficient mouse to undo the label. But they come six to a six pack, obviously. They also come individually wrapped. Someone would go on the website, which is easily known as browniepops.com, and they can fax me an order or call me an order, and I ship anywhere. I don't like shipping Texas in August, but worse things have happened.
Right. Now, we haven't really described these. What's the core of them?
It's a dark, fudgy, some people think they're a truffle on a stick, some people think they're like fudge.
Yeah,
it's more of a fudgy brownie rather than a cakey brownie.
Right.
And it's circular, and then it's flavored. There's 11 different flavors.
Oh, so tell us what the flavors are. Yeah, tell us what the flavors are. I have them here, but you can say them.
Original, you could have walnut, Missouri mud instead of Mississippi mud, being that we...
Yeah, I thought that was cute, yeah.
...live on that borderline here, which is pecan and marshmallow. There's caramel. There is toffee, which is made with handmade toffee bits from a girl in Wisconsin.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, there's raspberry. Everyone is a chocolate base,
uh-huh.
And then they have the flavors are additional.
I see.
There is mocha, made with a Starbucks Turkish grind.
Yeah, you've got peanut butter.
Peanut butter, which is made with chunky peanut butter.
Uh-huh. And now, are they really intended to be individual? I mean, this was funny because you know how everybody at the gym is watching their calorie intake. I took some to the gym, and they were all sharing, passing them around. I mean, nobody ate the whole thing. Are they meant to be shared? Or?
No, they're not meant to be shared. I like my desserts rich, so I can eat more than one. A lot of people say they can't finish one, but I wouldn't share. Somebody can share. I wouldn't share one. I would share my six-pack, but I wouldn't share one.
There you go. Well, I shared mine with the mouse. And then so we've got the center, and then you said they're dipped in chocolate, but then they're also decorated on the outside.
Yes, they're decorated on the outside with different colors. I hand-color white chocolate, and that's to an inkling of the flavor that's inside. Red is raspberry, white is walnut, a tan is peanut butter, mocha is a dark chocolate and a lighter tan chocolate together. Missouri mud is purple malted, comes with the malted milk balls inside, is blue. Peppermint, made with York's peppermint patties, is green.
Uh-huh.
And then they can be hand-decorated for every holiday. St. Patrick's Day is this weekend, and they have green shamrocks on them, and they have birthday sprinkles, we have Valentine's sprinkles, we have Christmas sprinkles, we're getting ready to do Easter.
Yeah, you were saying you were trying to figure out how to do an Easter egg.
I'm trying to figure out how to do an Easter. We were playing this week trying to hand mold the brownies into the shapes of the Wizard of Oz.
What?
So we have our Wicked Witch. We have a ruby red slipper.
Oh,
and
really?
We have a witch hat. We have the house.
That's fabulous. Oh, that's great. And are you going to be in time to get those out? I guess you're ahead of time.
Yeah, for anyone who wants them, that's just to say we do specialty ones. We do weddings. You can do your wedding colors. You can do white on white. I just did a Sweet 16 surprise party, and we piped on 16, the letter 16, number 16 on each pop.
Yeah, I'm writing a piece on cupcakes, or I guess I wrote a piece on cupcakes, and you know this mad craze for cupcakes.
Yes, there is.
Yeah, and they could do anything with a cupcake. It's just amazing.
Yes.
In fact, I just negotiated with a baker in South Carolina to do a cupcake cake for our granddaughter's christening party.
Oh, how nice!
Yeah, I mean, and it's easy, and I it just not have to cut this huge cake.
Yeah, they lay them out and then they frost the whole thing as if it were one?
No, they make individual cupcakes and then they put them on like a little tree, like a holder.
Yes. We have someone here who did a witch. She laid them all out, the cupcakes, and then frosted as if it were one.
Oh, I see. And then you just pull it apart?
I guess.
Amazing, yeah.
Let's do that website again. I'm sure that you're going to get all kinds of crazy custom orders.
BrownieePops.com.
And it's BrowniePops.com.
Yes.
And it's a www.
Yes.
So,
right.
So listeners, don't be frightened. Think of what you'd like on a brownie pop. About the only thing you have to think about is how would you describe the size?
They are almost 2 ounces. Not quite. They're about an ounce and a half. A 2-inch by 2-inch circle.
So they're sort of halfway in size between a golf ball and a baseball?
Okay.
Probably
more like a golf ball.
I think golf ball.
So that's just to give you an idea, I suppose you could make them larger if people wanted them too, right?
Yes, we could make, I don't know why. Then you'd really have to share.
And Marcia can do anything she wants.
There you go.
That's
You could make baseballs for opening day, for season opening day.
He wants to come work for you, Martha.
No. I'm just speculating as to just exactly how many baseball-size brownie pops someone could eat.
I don't know. Anyhow, Marcia, say hello to Kansas City for us.
I will.
And
I will.
Say hello to Leawood, which is where we lived. And you're in
what
suburb?
That's where I live. I live in Leawood as
You're in Leawood. So anyhow, yeah. Remember I told you we lived in the Cloisters and you know it?
I sure do know it because I grew up on, I bet you shopped at the Payless grocery store.
I don't know. I don't think so.
It's too long ago for us to remember.
I grew up at 82nd Terrace and Row.
Well, that's okay. I know where that is.
Well, we were on 83rd something or other, 83rd Terrace, I think, or something like that. And I can't.
Yes, and Mission.
Yes. And it's the only place I ever lived that had a uniform garbage can code. we had all have the same garbage cans.
And there were no sidewalks. So if you wanted to walk to the mailbox, you had to walk on the road.
In the street. Well, yeah. The same on my street. There's no sidewalks.
But everything's up to date in Kansas City other than that, right?
Well, we're getting there.
Well, keep us posted if you come up with new ideas or anything. You know, we would like to know.
All right. Thank you.
And keep in touch.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming and talking to us. Yeah, Marcia. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. I think now it's time to take a break.
Right.
What can I say about Real Estate 101 in just 10 seconds? Not much, but in a whole hour? Now that's a different story. Join me, Phil Marcus, each Saturday afternoon at 1 here on Pittsburgh's Talk Radio, The Edge, AM 1550.
T1 Internet access wasn't affordable to many companies as little as 2 years ago. Service providers were charging in the thousands of dollars, keeping the benefits of a T1 connection out of most companies' reach. ASP Station is now offering the faster and more reliable T1 service at a price significantly less than 2 years ago. The speed of a T1 for both sending and receiving data is simply amazing and will change the way your business runs indefinitely. You'll wonder how you ever lived without it. Call ASP Station now for details, 412-661-6001, 412-661-6001. Log on aspstation.net for more information. ASP Station, it's the way to go, fast.
Call ASP Station now for details, 412-661-6001. That's 412-661-6001. Log on aspstation.net for more information. ASP Station, it's the way to go, fast.
Influenza is a serious disease.
Are you talking to me?
If you have asthma, diabetes, or other chronic medical conditions, yes.
Are you talking to me?
If you're 50 or older, yes. If your child is between 6 and 23 months, yes.
Are you talking to me?
If you live or work with those at high risk, yes. Influenza will kill as many as 36,000 people this year. It's that serious. Prevent influenza. Get immunized. A message from the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases.
Hi, everyone. This is Tom Rita, the networking guy and host of Pittsburgh's most unique business show, Business in the Fast Lane. We're on every Saturday morning from 12 noon to 1 p.m. right here on The Edge, 1550 a.m. For the past 24 months, we've been bringing the best and the brightest into our studios to offer you ideas, advice, and real-world examples to help you grow your business. So save those honeydews for the afternoon and join me, Tom Rita, every Saturday morning from 12 to 1 on The Edge for Business in the Fast Lane, Pittsburgh's best kept secret.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Remember to check out our website, onthemenuradio.com. That's www.onthemenuradio.com. And we have our first guest, who is Beatrice Hohenecker. Hello, Beatrice.
Hi.
Yes. You have written this book. I don't know where to start. It's so packed with information, we can't possibly count. How long did it take to research this?
Well, I don't know if you saw in the back that I'm also curating a museum exhibition.
Yes.
On the same topic. So it's hard to divide the research for each one, you know, the museum and the book. But I would say that all in all, since my first interest in tea, 7 years have passed.
Oh, I mean, listeners, the book is called Liquid Jade, The Story of Tea from East to West. And I don't know that there's anything left out in the story of tea from this book, Beatrice. It's so beautifully, beautifully researched.
It's such an exciting story. It's like a wonderful detective story as you unveil all of the things that have gone on that have been associated with tea. I'm, of course, delighted to know that you feature my native land in it extensively. I should also
under gin as well as tea.
I should also add that I don't think you note this in the book, but I have a feeling that the people who founded Starbucks might have read your book if you'd written it then. Because what they've done is to reinvent the coffee house.
Oh, yeah.
And the coffee house had an important part to play.
Yep.
In the development of the tea culture. So perhaps that's a good starting point for you to tell us a little bit of the story.
Yeah.
Where does it start, Beatrice?
Yeah,
tea.
That is the beginning of the story as far as the West is concerned. And the coffee houses, it's interesting because people will ask, we're talking about tea, but why are these called coffee houses? Well, it's because coffee, tea, and chocolate arrived from Africa and the New World and the Americas and China, respectively, more or less at the same time. And it's just, you know, just a matter of timing that these first establishments that served all three beverages were called coffee houses instead of tea houses because, you know, the first person who opened it started serving coffee first. And that's where really, I mean, tea was known before that, before the coffee houses, first of all, in Portugal and in Holland, because they brought it to Europe before the English and in aristocratic circles. But the coffee houses really were establishments for everyone. And they were an interesting center for, I think I said something in the book, like a petri dish for democracy, because everyone was, everyone except women, of course.
Yeah, now I was going to say to you, I mean, I don't think it's very democratic to exclude women.
Yeah, I recall, in fact, and I don't know if you mentioned this in the book, that the first London Stock Exchange, the starts of the London Stock Exchange selling stocks and shares, the offices were actually in the coffee houses. So,
yes.
So people didn't do their business in a conventional office. They did it up and down the street or sitting over a drink of their favorite beverage. But you mentioned the history of tea and tea in the East.
Yeah.
far before it was in the West. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, tea as an agricultural crop starts in China at least 2,000 years ago, by some account, even 3,000 years ago. The legend says 5,000 years ago, but it's a legend. As a plant, as a wild plant, though, and this is, has been the reason for a diatribe between China and India for a long time, as where the question being, where did tea really start? And the Chinese say, well, it started here because we had our first plantations, but the Indians are saying no.
It's wild.
It started here because it grew wild here before it even came to China.
But did it? I mean, is that true?
We don't know that.
No,
those are marketing devices.
Yeah. Well, no, you write that it's an evergreen. I never even knew that.
Yeah, it is an evergreen. And not only that, oh, but the history of tea is so full of surprises. In my research, that was one of the fun parts of doing such a long research, is to keep finding surprises. And now, of course, you know, many people know, but in the beginning, I didn't know that all of these teas that you see all over the place, caffeinated teas, not herbals.
Yeah, all come from the same plant.
Yeah. All come from the same plant.
So you're now going to explain the differences between green, black, white, red, whatever.
If this is a good time, yes, I'll
sure, do
to.
That.
Okay. In the West, we first of all, different countries have different categories, and the Chinese being the most complex ones. But in the West, we recognize three main categories of tea. Black, green, and oolong. The difference is not the plant, because it is the same plant. And just to complete that, I will say that it is the same plant, but it does have two main varieties, and it is the Chinese and the Indian variety. The Indian variety comes from Assam, and it's called Camellia sinensis variety assamica, and the Chinese is Camellia sinensis variety sinensis, which is the one that grows in Darjeeling. But the rest of India, most of it has, especially in Assam, has that variety. That said, black tea can be made with both, of course. Green tea is made with the same, and oolong is made with the same. The difference is the processing of the leaf. And the two extremes are black and green, and oolong is somewhere in the middle. Black undergoes a process of oxidation, which is also very commonly called fermentation, but it is really oxidation.
Okay.
That means that the leaves, after they are plucked, they start to wither, and then they are rolled, and then they are put on huge, long, flat surfaces to oxidate, which is the same thing that happens to an apple or an avocado if you cut it in half and you put it on the counter and it turns brown.
Right.
And then they are dried in the dryers, and then they're sorted and graded. All of this happens in the same way for the green and the oolong teas, except the oxidation. That's why when you actually brew black tea, what we call black tea, the Chinese call it red tea, just to make things more complicated, the liquor, what's called the liquor, which is the liquid, the brewed tea, is kind of brownish, but the green tea is sort of yellowish, because the leaves that are used have not been oxidated.
Right. Now, there's another wonderful turning point in tea, and somebody called Twining had something to do with that.
Yes, interesting. And that goes back to what, Anne, you were saying earlier when you said that it was not very democratic for women to be allowed in the coffee houses. Well, Twining turned that around without, who knows, maybe he wasn't really thinking about being democratic toward women, but
he was making money.
Yes. And that same shop is still there. I visited it 300 years later.
You're
in
kidding.
The same place.
And where is it?
It's on the Strand in London.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Yeah, same shop, Golden Lion.
Uh-huh. So, but you didn't entirely explain it. What happened is Mr. Twining started selling tea to take away, which had not been heard of before.
Exactly.
So ladies could take it away, and they could have little tea parties at home with cucumber sandwiches and
absolutely
all those kinds of things. So the English institution called tea was essentially enabled by Mr. Twining, I guess.
Yeah, he was the first one, but then as soon as he had the idea of selling dried leaf tea, everybody started selling, and you could find dried leaf tea everywhere.
Now, what about bags, tea bags? When did those come into being?
Well, the lore is that at the beginning of the 20th century, a tea trader, an American tea trader, started sending out samples in muslin bags.
Oh, cute.
And because I guess he was saving on the shipping or whatever, and people took these little muslin bags and thought that they were supposed to throw those in the teapot. And we're very happy about that, because then they didn't have to clean.
Exactly.
You know how long it takes to clean a teapot,
right,
to empty out the leaves. And so they requested more, and thus the tea bag was born.
Now let's do one thing. Let's do the opium wars and tea.
Ah, that's what actually got me interested in tea in the first place. Going back to the coffee houses, in the 1600s, tea arrived around, you know, in the first half of the 17th century. But in the 1700s, it exploded as an item of mass consumption. And the British were buying huge amounts of tea from China, and they wanted to trade with other items, but the Chinese were an ancient culture with advanced technologies, and they didn't need anything, so they just wanted to be paid in cash. And believe it or not, this had begun to create a fairly serious trade imbalance in England.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Now, so what the English did is that they looked for an item that they were sure to be able to sell into China, and that item was opium. Now, they were not the first ones. The Dutch did that, too. But the English were the ones who turned it into a global commerce and started huge opium plantations and processing centers in northern India, and then would ship them through country traders, independent traders, into China. In the beginning, opium was not illegal, but then it became illegal because the emperor tried to stem the flowing of opium into the country.
I see.
So, but it didn't stop. It became bigger and bigger and bigger.
Mm.
And now tea was not the only, I wouldn't say that tea was the only cause of it, but it was the trigger. This is in the larger context of China as a waning empire and England as a waxing international superpower.
Right.
This is not a particularly noble period of colonial history,
yeah,
I guess.
We're going to skip over that.
We probably shouldn't dwell on that. I should probably quit while I'm ahead.
Beatrice, you speak all these languages. You studied in Italy. Are you Italian?
Yes, I'm half Italian, half German.
Okay, so it's
Beatrice. So I studied
Beatrice.
In Italy. I was born and raised there, but I went to German school there.
I see, because you were at the La Sapienza University of Rome.
Yes, that's where I studied after high school.
Yeah, so it says you're fluent in English, French, Italian, and German.
Yeah, because I lived in Paris for 7 years also.
But you're not Chinese.
Yeah, that is a great, great frustration of mine, because I cannot read some of these.
That's what I was wondering, how you did the research.
Well, listeners, this book is a great read, I know, because I've been great reading it. It's called Liquid Jade. You can buy it at www.onthemenuradio.com. I just put it up there the other day, Beatrice, you'll be pleased to know.
Thank you.
And I haven't done reading the exciting story yet. I can barely put it down because I don't know what part of cultural history you're going to tie to tea next.
Yeah, see, I think that what everybody should know. I mean, we could talk to you for 3 hours, Beatrice, but we don't have 3 hours, and I think nobody's going to get the gist of how wonderful this book is unless they actually pick it up and read it. And the fact that you are a gifted storyteller along with a superb researcher makes it really wonderful.
Thank you for this wonderful conference.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us, and keep us posted.
Oh, yes, definitely I will. And thank you very much for having me on and giving me a chance to talk about tea, which I never tire of.
Well, great. We'll be in touch again then.
Bye for now.
Okay. Yeah, we need to take a break. Thanks, Beatrice.
Thank you.
So we'll take a break.
Furnace working okay? How's your heating bills? You know, no kidding, an old or inefficient furnace can really add to the cost of keeping your home warm. If you want to keep costs down, get your furnace looked at, and I recommend Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning for that. The technicians at Bolster DeHart have been performing routine maintenance and installing high-efficiency heating and air conditioning systems in Pittsburgh since 1977. They're EPA-certified professionals who are continually factory-trained in all the latest installation and service techniques. They offer free estimates and don't even charge extra for Saturday service. They're a quality dealer you can trust. Stay warm this winter at the lowest possible cost. Call Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning at 412-367-3900. Maintenance or installation, Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning, 412-367-3900.
It's Saturday. You and your wife take the boys to the mall, straight to the food court. Your wife and Pete head for tacos. You and Danny want Chinese. You look up at the menu for a few seconds. You look down to see what Danny wants. But you don't see Danny. Your eyes dart around frantically. You instinctively call out,
Danny! Danny!
From the taco place, you hear a voice.
Hey! Dad! Change my mind!
Every parent knows that feeling when, even for a few seconds, you lose sight of your child. Imagine if he or she were actually abducted. Go to wirelessamberalerts.org. Sign up for free Amber Alerts on your cell phone. When an Amber Alert is issued in the areas you've chosen, you'll receive a free text message. If you spot the vehicle, the suspect, or the child described in the alert, call 911. Sign up today at wirelessamberalerts.org. A child is calling for help. This message brought to you by the Wireless Foundation, the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and the Ad Council.
Data security and speed can be what puts your business ahead of your competition. But cost is important, too. You might be paying every month for bandwidth you don't use. Let's talk about your company's disaster recovery system. Is it as effective and secure as it could be? What are you paying for your T1 line? I'll bet we can offer you a better deal. We're ASP Station, a premier independent server co-location facility and high-speed internet access provider. Virtually unlimited bandwidth, co-location for your backup servers, off-site system backup, and secure access to your equipment 24/7. Check us out on the web at aspstation.net or call us at 412-661-6001. Easy number to remember, 412-661-6001. ASP Station, 412-661-6001.
You are listening to The Edge, AM 1550, WURP, Braddock, Pittsburgh.
You're listening to On the Menu, and we're going to jump from, since we're already discussing England in a different context, we're going to jump to London and pick up some of our interviews we did there recently. Who's up first?
Today we have a charming, large Irishman called Richard Corrigan, who was one of the hardest interviews to schedule I've ever had. I finally caught up with him at his establishment and talk to him about his entire empire of restaurants. So here's Richard.
Richard Corrigan is a larger-than-life personality in a variety of different ways. First of all, he's a wonderful Irishman to talk to. He's a physical presence, too. But more than anything, he has a big stamp on the London dining market that's only going to get bigger. Richard, tell us about the Corrigan enterprises in the restaurant field that are already running in London.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't know about the empire you're talking about, really. I mean, 10 years based in a tiny little house in Soho on three levels in a basement kitchen. It seems a long time to build an empire without having an empire. Bentley's seafood restaurant, which we acquired last year, has been the recent addition to Lindsay House, really, our little company. Going back to Lindsay, I mean, it's been there 25 years as a restaurant. It's been in my hands for the last 10 years, and it's a difficult little townhouse, and the lease is coming to an end in 3 years' time, and it's been a fabulous show.
So, do you get that, listeners? Sometime in the next 3 years, you got to go there. I was there yesterday, and it was a wonderful experience, so you really must try not to miss out. But anyway, back to Bentley's, and then tell us about the new adventure that I guess is really becoming imperial.
Well, just a quick word about Bentley's. I mean, Bentley's is a seafood restaurant in London. It's going since 1916. Customers included Charlie Chaplin. I mean, it really is a part of the London dining scene. I'm very, very pleased to it's in my company. I used to work here as head chef, and we've turned it back to a great restaurant, what I think a great restaurant or seafood restaurant is in London. Bakery in the basement. Great attitude to fish purchasing, you know, no endangered species on our menu. So we're very passionate about what we've done here, and it's been a great success. The new operation down on Park Lane is the old Nico at 90 site, for those who might know it. It was called Nico at 90, and Nico retired around 4 or 5 years ago, and the restaurant laid empty. And I think the hotel tried to get a lot of individual chefs in there, and it really never seemed to work out. I mean, I approached them, and I bought the lease of the restaurant, and we have a 15-year lease. So really, we'll see my cooking time out in London, as far as I'm concerned, and then it'll be back to Ireland to do spotted salmon fishing.
It's funny, you said you started out that way with your father, fishing wild salmon and harvesting other things that were part of your life growing up, and then you were in the kitchen at 14. Well, he just said it. Richard just said to me, without the microphone in his hand, when he started out, it wouldn't have been legal, but that's fine because it was all part of growing up. And so many people we talk to, their background is the same. You were telling me before we began that there's a real community of chefs here in London you're a part of, and many of them probably have exactly that same background starting out.
I think the community of chefs working in London are very, very close to one another. They tend to have a great personal relationship. We tend to help each other. We're very close, you know what I mean? We work very well together, which is unusual in the bitchy kind of kitchen scene of most high-profile restaurants, you know. I mean, no matter what anyone thinks of Gordon, I mean, he's been a good friend to our operation and a great, he's been dined here many, many times. And it just shows you that, you know what I mean, whatever media profile you have, there's always a great side to most of the seemingly bad guys out there.
You mentioned Gordon Ramsay. Who are some of your other pals?
Well, I mean, from ex-John Burton Race, we have Gordon, we have Tom Aiken, we have Shane Osborne down in Peter Tare, we have the chef over in Brest, over in Ledbury. I mean, we've done a charity event in South Africa, myself and Brest, Liam Tomlin, who used to have the bank in Sydney. I mean, we really, really have a close, close community who've worked brilliantly with me. And, you know, I've been involved as a little helping out a friend of mine, Tony Ryan, who set up the Ryanair Empire. He built the village at Lines in Kildare, and I had to ask some of my colleagues in London to get some staff over to him, and everyone dished up, you know, gave me someone. And I just thought, you know, it's great to have friends in London, you know what I mean? That's why we all tend to be complimentary about one another, because, you know, it's very easy to kind of, you know, be jealous of someone else's success and whatever. But, you know, here, you know, we really are, you know, we're help each other in any way possible. Just because, you know what, success is, can be elusive. When you've got it, it's nice to help each other.
Before we break down this particular session, I want to ask you a really difficult question. When you're not cooking for yourself, where are your two favorite places to go?
Well, my two favorite places to go, number one has to be the Gavroche. And I like the Gavroche because I just feel like a king when I'm sitting there. I think Salviano is one of the greatest front of house people that I know, I've ever known in my life. And I do like the Ruse. I like Michel in the Waterside. I like Albert. I like Young Michel. They're absolutely great ambassadors for our industry. They've been incredibly supportive in my to my business, and especially Michel in the Waterside, who really, his advice over the last couple of months to me and my business, that we've expanded our business, has been absolutely invaluable. And really, if I had PricewaterhouseCoopers to pay the same advice to, I'd be in a lot poorer today.
I'm going to ask Richard Corrigan to do almost the impossible, and in a few minutes, to give us a cook's tour of what's on the menu at Lindsay House, what's on the menu at Bentley's, and what's going to be on the menu at the new place. I'm also going to ask you if you have a name picked yet for the new place, so that listeners who don't listen all the time and get all the news about when it's going to happen know what to look at. So let's start with Lindsay House, because that's probably the right place to start. What's on the menu at Lindsay House?
Well, Lindsay House menu changes very, very often indeed. We don't hold back. And it's one of the few restaurants that I really know. It's one of the few restaurants that I really know that, you know, has a very kind of carefree attitude, in the sense of, you know, we've loads of dishes in our head. We tend to keep the menus changing the whole time. I hate the idea and really dislike the idea that menus should stay in stowing for years. And so the chefs end up repetitious, and we'd probably have two Michelin stars probably if we didn't change our menus every week. You know, but my bakery that bakes all the bread, the organic butter on the table, there's a sense of kind of, you know what I mean, a little bit of creativity, restrained creativity. I mean, people... The dishes, I would say, is reflected. Would I eat them myself? That's why then I put them on the menu. If there's not something on the menu that I wouldn't like, I would never put it on the menu.
So an example of that would be pig's feet stuffed with dried morels and sweetbreads?
Yeah, I mean, the stuffed pig's foot is absolutely fantastic. And I know there's many, many variations of the stuffed pig's foot, but I think the way we do it is absolutely a blinding dish. Served with that homemade choucroute we do as well, the pickled cabbage. And, you know, if it's a rabbit stuffed with feta-like cheese, which is basically a Pyrenees sheep's cheese, and the chorizo from Spain, which is basically a wonderful sausage from the Brindisa Spanish food company in London, who have been supportive of me over the last many, many years. I like the flavors of Southern Europe, but I don't like them to dominate the menu. I think the food that I cook, with an expression of longitudes and latitudes of where we are in the British Isles, I like to think there's a seasonality and a common approach to the way we cook. It seems simple, but by God, the work goes behind it is very well crafted indeed. And sometimes just to show off, as they say, look at the art on the place. Well, I really would argue with a lot of people about food and art. I eat because I like eating. I like cooking because I like pleasing people. So therefore, I like just giving people good food that they can identify with as well. So that's the really common approach. There's lots of great ingredients, naturally smoked haddock, but the hand-rolled macaroni and spring onion, absolutely blinding dish. And then the tartare, you didn't have the mackerel tartare? No, that's an absolute blinder. I mean, with the caviar vinaigrette, with the beetroot kind of sabayon on the top. You know what I mean? That's us being saying, listen, you know, you have a little simple piece of fish there, and then we have something really smart. But you know what? We can do it, but it doesn't have to dominate our menu.
So will the style of the new place be similar to that?
I think the style of the new restaurant on Park Lane, what I don't want is a kind of a homage to Richard Corrigan restaurant. I like the feeling of Bentley's, what we've done here. I like the common approach. We have all sorts of people coming in, rich people, middle-income people, tourists, and everyone is coming in for good food. I would really like to take that feeling that we have in Bentley's across to Park Lane. But, of course, the dishes won't be a fish restaurant. It will be certainly game will feature very strongly in the winter in Nice. But really, we will take the best of Lindsay House will come with us. But we will leave back some of the maybe frivolous side of Lindsay House will be left behind. It is a small house. You cannot transport Lindsay to Park Lane. It's completely unique. So therefore, a lot of our dishes will be new to Park Lane, but I think it will work very well there.
Now, just a quick word on Bentley's. Obviously, it's oysters, it's crab, picked fresh every day. What other kinds of things, Richard?
Well, you know, the large cherry stone clams, or clams that we get in, the large number one langoustines. Everything is cooked fresh here. All the crabs are prepared every morning. The bakery churns out all the bread. I mean, this is an eating house extraordinaire as far as I'm concerned. We are fastidious in our approach. We are military in our discipline. And it just shows you, behind all great food, no matter what level and how interesting or uninteresting, there's a huge discipline behind what you do. And without it, you just cannot produce good food. And Bentley's, we've definitely achieved that.
One last word for on the menu listeners around the world, Richard.
Well, you know, I think London is an incredibly exciting place. You know, Bentley's restaurant is going since 1916. It's great that I'm the custodian of it. And that's how I feel about London restaurants. I am the custodian of it. And in my time of owning these restaurants, I want to be known as great eating houses. Lindsay House, Bentley's, and of course, you know, Corrigan's on Park Lane, which will be called Corrigan's, the new restaurant on Park Lane. And so a very exciting time ahead, you know, a worrying time, you know what I mean? But, you know, you have to grow up, you know what I mean? You need a company to, and you need to expand your company, but not too much. I think our three restaurants now, that will be it. But I just feel you need to be a bit bigger than we were 10 years ago to be able to afford the best staff and the best ingredients and corner things that I want to corner. A small restaurant's always struggling in London financially.
So, listeners, we broke the news, at least in some parts of the world, about Corrigan's on Park Lane. Keep in touch with us. We'll be making a posting when we know it's going to open and it's time to start making reservations. Richard, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And I believe now you have to run off and look at food.
Yeah, I am. I'm going down to the Harrods Food Hall because they put a new section in. And we're really nosy, you know what I mean? But that's what makes us who we are. So we see what they're doing. And I think it's really important to be nosy. You must keep, it's nothing wonderful going into markets, farmers markets this time of the year, and just seeing what things are in season. And to cook with things that are in season is absolutely inspiring.
So he was good.
I'm sorry I missed that. Of course, I was at the hotel recovering from food poisoning.
Not feeling well. But Richard was going to hop on his friend's motorcycle and they were going to cycle over to from Piccadilly Circus to Harrods to look at the food hall.
Yeah.
He did tell me.
I need to add that yes. I did not get the food poisoning from any of these restaurants.
Oh, no.
I want to make that very clear. I know exactly how I got food.
So it's Bentley's for seafood. It's Lindsay House for the range of Richard Corrigan's cooking. On a later program, I have an interview that I recorded with the chef who was on duty at Lindsay House, so don't miss that one when it's upcoming. He's a real character. There's really no question about that. He speaks for himself. His food speaks for him, too. And I think right now it's probably time for us to take a break. So we'll take a break.
Hi, friends. I'm Phil Marcus, the host of Real Estate 101, heard every Saturday here on The Edge, AM 1550. If you've been thinking about selling your house or buying a house, I'd like to speak with you. Choosing the right agent is one of the first and most important steps in the process of buying or selling real estate. It's critical that you choose an agent who has the knowledge and experience to not only find that perfect new home for you, but to also be able to guide you step by step through the often complicated real estate process. If you don't already have a realtor, may I offer my services? I I've been a real estate agent in Pittsburgh for almost 30 years. I'm a life member of the Realtors Association, and I'm proud to say that I've earned both the GRI and the coveted CRS professional designations. Won't you call me at RE/MAX Heritage? The phone number is 412-241-4200, extension 154, or my email address is phil@philmarcus.com. That's 412-241-4200, extension 154, or phil@philmarcus.com. Let's talk.
The internet is crucial to your business. Everybody knows this, but did you know Nidhogg is the company you should call for internet service? Nidhogg, personal web page hosting for less. Business web page hosting. Nidhogg offers both Unix and NT server support. Nidhogg is the company you should call for dedicated internet access. Nidhogg offers DSL for high speed, low cost, always on access. DSL is great. It means no more dial up. Oh, by the way, do you remember that thing called the telephone? Do you remember when people used phone lines to access the internet? Oh, I'm sorry, you still use dial-up? Well, Nidhogg does that too. Local access telephone numbers? Okay, I don't understand it all either, but I do know that I need it, and I know where to get it. Nidhogg, Nidhogg.com, 412-661-5917. That's 661-5917, or log on, Nidhogg.com. Internet the Nidhogg way.
Have you been jazzing around yet? It's Sundays from 10 to 12 here on 1550. Get a taste of the latest jazz album, the concert and club calendar, birthdays, awards, obituaries, and more. Plus featured artist interviews. That's a lot of jazzing. Check it out for yourself. Sponsored in part by Martini's Route 885 Jefferson, Original Recipe Italian Cooking, and Spider Mondanelli's Pittsburgh Jazz Giants, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Jazzing around. Sundays, 10 to 12 here on 1550 The Edge.
Welcome to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and give a warm welcome to Chef Lawrence Keough from Roast in Borough Market. Hi, Lawrence.
How are you?
Okay. sorry I missed you. I mean, you're at my favorite place, Borough Market.
It's wonderful, isn't it? Hey?
Yeah, I love Borough Market in London.
And for those who've been to Borough Market before, first up, Lawrence, tell our listeners where Roast is.
Well, Roast restaurant is built just above the market. It's in actually glass. You can see in from the market. It's a wonderful site. It was originally the floral hall many years ago, and it was used for like all the flowers at the market. But I don't think they lasted too well in the whole regard because of all the amount of windows in here. Because the original part of the roofing is taken from Covent Garden, so it can get very bright on a hot sunny day here.
Uh-huh.
Oh, no kidding. So the building was always there, but it was substantially refurbished for you, correct?
Yeah, it was an empty shell when we got here about 20 months ago when I first looked at the site. It was just an empty shell, you know, it was just like tumbleweed and rubbish in here.
Now, are you a partner or not?
No, I was approached to come here and open the restaurant. I was a very busy restaurant called The Avenue in St. James's, London.
Okay.
Which was a very busy eatery, high-profile venue. Previously, before that, I was with Marco Pierre White and a guy called Rowley Lee at Kensington Place, London.
Oh, there you go. Incidentally, we just had Richard Corrigan on the program recorded after I left Roast. I went from Roast and then went to interview Richard Corrigan, and then you're following him. So the Irish are winning today.
Oh, good. But it's St. Patrick's Day tomorrow.
There you go.
And there's some good facilities that are lined up for the market and the menu. We've got a nice menu lined up tomorrow as well.
That's great. Well, tell me about some of the wonderful things that you cook for me.
Well, as you said, you know, we're a British restaurant, and we only use British seasonal produce. That's what the angle I was going at. I don't use asparagus or strawberries out of season. And whatever's good in season at the moment, it could be something simple like cauliflowers and simple vegetables. We'll just do that on the menu, what's coming good into the market. But the same with the meat and the fish. Whatever's looking good that week that's coming in, that's seasonal, we get it straight on the menu. Once it starts, you know, deteriorating or not being that it's good or the season's dying, we just jump off it. So we are like seasonal hoppers, I suppose you could call us.
But you've
we
got
jump
some
on the bandwagon of anything that's good in the market.
But you've got some standards. You're probably going to have oysters on the menu all the time.
We have some oysters. We're using the Carlingford Rock Irish oysters at the moment in anticipation for tomorrow. I had some excellent Duchy of Cornwall oysters on the menu recently, and Malden Rock oysters, but we pot our own shrimps at Roast, and we smoke our own mackerel, and we pickle our own herrings. We do a lot of old traditional puddings as well, old British stuff, spotted dick.
I knew you were going to say spotted dick.
And I had this one, I had this wonderful black pudding hash.
Oh, you did. That's right, you did. Yeah, that's very popular. I don't think I'll be able to take that dish off the menu, Peter. It's a lovely dish. We braise oxtail slowly till it falls off the bone, and then we mix it in with black pudding. I get it from a company in Scotland called Ramsay's of Carluke.
Oh, so you're actually, well, we can't call it adulterating. You're adding to the black pudding.
Yeah, and then we just fry in a little blini pan and turn it out, and we serve it with an apple sauce. But what I do in the apple sauce, I just put a few teaspoons of ground mace into the apple sauce to give it a bit of a lift and a bit of a spice.
There you go. Let's see, we had scallops. I had wonderful scallops with the rose on them.
That's right, yeah. I'm trying to remember what the dish, because you came in a couple of weeks ago, and then the menu's been changed a little bit now, and I'm trying to remember what produce we were using, actually.
There were diver scallops, and they had wild mushrooms and sea purslane.
The sea purslane, yeah. We've got a forager that works for us. He's a bit of a hippie kind of character. He picks wild leaves and mushrooms from around London and around the country, and he goes out, and there's lots of things in the forest that he goes and picks for us, and sea purslane is one of them.
And what is sea purslane?
Well, it's slightly salty. It's cultivated in Holland, actually. It's slightly salty. It looks like it resembles like rosemary, but when you eat it, it's slightly salty flavor to it, and it's excellent in seafood.
It doesn't look like purslain.
Yeah.
It does not
really
look
good.
Like purslain.
It's not the same as purslain, but it's smaller stalks. They're quite hardy to eat, actually. They need a bit of a blanch and refresh,
okay.
And sprinkle them into a salad or pan fry them with scallops last minute with some butter and lemon. And if you can get hold of sea purslain, it's excellent. It grows on shores and things like that.
Now, what do you do about liability when people are peddling wild mushrooms to your doorstep?
Oh, I don't buy stuff like that. Well, I've got suppliers next door to me, so I don't do stuff like that.
You know? I see. So, but this, how do you know that these are not poisonous mushrooms? Your forager, isn't he foraging?
Oh, no, but he's a forager, but he's also fully trained. I mean, you know, he might be picking some kind of mushrooms that, you know, he might be picking some penny bun mushrooms and penny bun that are similar to seps and things like this, you know, uh-huh. And porcinis. Seps and porcinis are all the same. And in England, penny bun, and we have things, there's Pied de Mouton in French, and I've forgot the name of them in English, but they're all different English names.
Yeah.
But it's always sort of on these shores.
Lamb's
we don't
feet.
Like, pick anything
Lamb's.
Like that's bright red with white spots that look kind of crazy looking.
Now, you have a very special dish on the menu that comes with a rather unusual presentation. It's sort of, it's pink and it's like newspaper.
Oh, the fish and chips?
Go ahead.
Was it the fish and chips you had, wasn't it, in the newspaper?
Well, I didn't know. You showed it to me coming out. I didn't know.
Yeah, what
I didn't
we do
have,
on a Friday, we make a beer batter.
For that.
We use beer and self-raising flour, and we get haddock from Cornwall, and we flour it, and we deep fry. We do fish and chips, basically. We cut our own chips, but every Friday we do fish and chips, which is traditional, as you know, in London.
Yeah.
And all across the UK,
yeah.
But we serve it. Traditionally, years ago, the newspaper, you would buy fish and chips, and they would wrap it in newspapers and fish and chip shops years ago. So what we do, we wrap it in the Financial Times in London.
Yeah. they do that at Royal Crescent in Bath.
Do they?
Yeah.
We've done it first.
Yeah, I think I told you that I had recognized it from somewhere else and reminded me that's where it was. Now, what do you fry the fish in? I think
beef dripping.
Beef dripping, there we go.
Yeah, every Friday we use beef dripping. There's a famous restaurant up in Whitby in Yorkshire that has queues going outside all around the block, and they have a queue. Like, I think it's called the Mayflower. It's in Whitby, but my God, the fish and chips are supposed to be delicious. Everyone that says who's been to Whitby goes like on a pilgrimage and has their fish and chips.
Uh-huh.
So what I do, I've bought in the dripping myself and done it, and my God, it does taste fantastic. The chips taste excellent.
Now, you were doing Yorkshire beef when I visited. Have you moved on from that now?
Yeah, we've done the Yorkshire promotion now. We've got Taste of Anglia to do in the next month, and later on in the year, I've got to do Taste of the South East. So all the regional food groups throughout the UK are working closely with us, because obviously they want to highlight the produce and the farmers and the producers from these regions, which, you know, they go totally unnoticed, some of them, you know.
Right, well, let's make sure the listeners know all about the restaurant. Website is www.roast-yorkshire.com.
or -restaurant.com, not .co.uk.
Yeah.
And the location is the Borough Market, which is adjacent to the London Bridge Underground Station.
Yeah.
And it's wouldn't be fair to say you can't miss it, but it's hard to miss, and all you have to do is ask somebody where it is anyway.
Yeah.
You'll have a wonderful experience, because it's not just a space where the good food comes out. It's an extremely elegant interior space with a high ceiling and lots of windows to let the English sunlight in. And
right.
Lawrence, give us some last thoughts before we close the program.
Well, I think it's one of them visits you have to do when you come to London. It's like when you go to Barcelona, you go to the Boqueria. You must come to Borough Market.
It's got
fantastic traditions. The heritage goes back. There has been a market on this site since Roman times, and it's very Victorian area. There's some beautiful parts of the area around here, some lovely architecture.
Yeah, you know, if you go on our website, www.onthemenuradio.com, there's a photograph of me and Jamie Oliver in Borough Market.
Wonderful.
Did you ever check that? Yeah.
let's also not forget that you serve breakfast, you serve brunch, you serve Sunday lunch.
Yeah.
Tea.
And afternoon tea.
And afternoon tea. Oh, my goodness.
Cucumber sandwiches, yeah, and scones, yeah.
You just never stop.
We're basically a hotel without the rooms.
That's true. So if you weren't cooking at Roast, where would you be cooking?
Me?
Yeah.
Probably at home.
And what do you cook when you're cooking at home?
All kinds of things. All kinds. I cook a lot of pasta, all kinds of things. But to be honest, when I get home, I let my partner cook, because she's a very straightforward cook. She does simple things for me, and I think I appreciate it when I get home so much more. And I enjoy it when I don't have to cook at home. It's a pure luxury when someone else puts food in front of you.
Yeah, well, I've heard that from a lot of chefs, actually. But, I mean, one of the things I always do is ask chefs what they like to eat at home.
Yes, my favorite. I think I make spaghetti meatballs a lot, actually. I like doing it on Saturday nights for the kids. They love rolling the meatballs out with me and cooking them off, and it's fun to eat. And I quite like spaghetti meatballs.
And how many kids do you have?
I've got two.
Okay, how old?
He's soon to be six, and a daughter that's 20 months.
Oh, my goodness, 20 months. That's wonderful.
There you go.
That's not bad at all, is it?
Yeah, but kids, I don't know why kids adore spaghetti and meatballs, but
it's great fun to watch them eat it, isn't it?
Yeah, but this has been the standard birthday fare for our son Adam his whole entire life, and his bride continues this tradition.
Well, Lawrence, thank you. I'm looking at a picture postcard of a full roast breakfast.
Right. Oh, the full borough.
Run down a full borough before you say goodbye.
Well, it's a variation on the full English. Any restaurant or any hotel you stay in London, you'll order the full English breakfast, which is sausage, egg, bacon, tomatoes and mushrooms. But because we're in Borough Market, we call it the full borough.
Right.
And there's sausage, egg, bacon, tomatoes, mushrooms, black pudding, fried bread. It's a feast.
Is that fried bread on the top that looked like flatbread?
Yeah, there's fried bread on there as well.
Wow, amazing.
Lawrence, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Yeah.
Pleasure. And I'm in the middle of service. I've had to jump out. The restaurant's full.
You better go back to work. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thanks,
no problem.
Lawrence.
Take care.
I'll
bye.
See you next trip. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Well, I mean, it sounded like they were all having such a good time. I'm sorry I missed that.
It was a good time. It's a great place to go. And don't forget Lawrence's advice. Go visit the Borough Market either before or after.
It's my favorite place.
On either Friday or Saturday.
Yeah,
and listeners,
that's when it's open to the public.
Same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.
Jazzin' Around with David J. is next on The Edge, AM 1550.